this is Neil Funk, and you're listening to Frick on the Chicago Bullseye.
Hello, this is Nick Friedel, and you're listening to Frick on the Chicago Bullseye. Hi, this is Chuck Swirsky, and you're listening to Frick on the Chicago Bullseye.
Hello again, everybody. Welcome to another exciting edition of the Chicago Bullseye. We have a special episode today with the world-famous intellectual and great writer Ricky O'Donnell. Ricky and I spoke shortly after the devastating news of the Dunn injury. Before we get to Ricky, I'd like to share with you a true story. All of you who are close to me probably already know this story, but for those of you who don't or haven't heard it, I was reminded of the situation when I heard the news about the Dunn injury, and I'll share it with you now. So just after the turn of the century, I was part of a very successful 50s and 60s cover band called Gigglewater. We played Elvis, the Beatles, Chuck Berry, Stones, all the classics from that era. We were all, you know, pretty young guys playing this classic rock and roll. And we kind of developed a pretty big following on the South Side and the South Burbs from where I'm from. I don't like to brag, but I mean, we were probably the greatest cover band that ever did this type of music since, you know, Sha Na Na, I'd say. Anyhow. So I played guitar, kazoo, I sang a few songs. I also, though, managed the band. I finally got us a deal to play in Chicago. It's very difficult sometimes to get really well-paid gigs in the city, or it was at that time. I'm not going to tell you the establishment, but it was a big deal. It was a shouting distance from the Cubby Bear in Wrigleyville. So it was a big, you know, well-known place. So the gig was for 1 hour, $1,000, to open up for a band called Midget Wrestling. So I invited everyone I knew. Many of my dear friends were there. My fiance, who's now my wife, my sisters, neighbors, acquaintances. All these people came to support us in our first, you know, major show in the city. Well, we showed up, and there wasn't a band, but there was an actual ring and, like, little people who were wrestlers. So I, you know, slack-jawed, couldn't believe it, but you know, we're not opening up for a band, guys, called Midget Wrestling. We're actually opening up for actual midgets that are wrestling. You know, the guys were, and I, too, were pretty disappointed, but whatever. You know, let's be professional and let's get this going. So you should know our primary, I'd say, demographic for our band at the time was women between the ages of 35 and 55, I'd estimate it to be. The attendees at this bar to watch Midget Wrestling were primarily young, drunk, morons that weren't really interested in hearing us saying, you know, don't be cruel. So it was not a good atmosphere, to say the least, to start out the show. So we opened up with Surfin' USA, and within a minute, this chant rose, you know, we want the midgets, we want the it just devolved into beer throwing, basically a scene straight out of the Blues Brothers movie at Bob's Country Bunker. So we're figuring out, what can we do? We did Roadhouse Blues. We knew that song by the Doors, which kind of stopped the chanting that we thought would be a little bit more in our demographic. But the friction between us and the crowd, it just continued to grow. So after that song was finished, we were getting thoroughly booed. I mean, people were just screaming at us, booing, throwing stuff. And the guy who sang most of our songs, Dave, decided he had enough. And he just gets in the mic and says, you know, what's wrong with you people? What kind of people would want to watch midgets wrestle? And, you know, it was probably a mistake in retrospect. At that moment, the head wrestler, Meathead, who's their star midget wrestler, decides to jump on stage. He grabs my Les Paul, which I had two guitars. I had a Telecaster, which I was playing at that moment, and my Les Paul was on a stand. He picked it up, and he broke my guitar like Pete Townsend at the end of a Who concert. So what happened next can only be described as complete chaos. I found myself in a physical altercation with Meathead. And unfortunately for my reputation, Meathead got the better of me due to his, you know, low center of gravity, his normal-sized adult strength. The guy was like a piece of iron. It was like punching a fire hydrant. He was so strong. It was, but obviously embarrassment, because if you're far away from the scene, it looks like you're actually fighting a 10-year-old. But, you know, big picture here, my equipment's destroyed. Favorite guitar destroyed. My manhood destroyed. Establishment, the place refused to pay us due to starting a riot. So what I thought going into the evening would be such a promising step towards musical stardom, you know, basically instead turned into a complete nightmare. And I had a little crazed person screaming expletives at me, calling me a derogatory name for a cat in front of my family, my friends, you know, my fiance. So I drove home completely emasculated, tears in my eyes, depressed. And I was reminded of that night when I was driving in the car yesterday, right around, you know, I'd say, was it 1 o'clock I heard the news? I was in the car and I get the news, Dunn's out 6 weeks. And I just thought about that night with the midgets. Dream of 47 wins, destroyed. My hope I could win the bet with Mark K from Australia and Bulls HQ, destroyed. My Jabari Parker prediction for All-Star greatness, destroyed. Everything I predicted about this team, all destroyed. And I'm at rock bottom, you know, friends. So, rock bottom. Another question is, you know, where do we go from here? You know, Gigawater, we can go down the way of Gigawater. We never rarely played in public again after that due to the financial ramifications of the riot. Do we want to go down that same path? Do we really want to do that? Because I'm not. I'm not going to live that nightmare again. I implore you guys, stay true to the cause. Things will get better because they can't get any worse. And most importantly, big picture, all we got to do is get through the next 6 weeks. Valentine's coming back. Lori's coming back. Dunn's coming back. It's not like they're gone all year. So we still have hope that the Red Leviathan's going to rise again, and I think it will. So anyhow, hope you enjoy this interview with the great Ricky O'Donnell. Check out a new Big Red Bus with podcasting godfather Doug Tonis. That should be out later today. Stay on this Big Red Bus, ladies and gentlemen. Do not leave the bus because I think the ride's going to be very nice by the end of this year. So go Bulls. Ricky O'Donnell, one of the Bulls Twitter's brightest minds, with his first appearance on the Chicago Bullseye. Ricky, how you doing, brother? It's an honor to have you on the show.
Thanks for finally having me, Fred. I feel like we talked about this for years, and I'm honored that I finally get a chance to appear on the show.
We've been following each other for a long time. It's got to be going back a decade. And at one time on the spectrum of seed redness, I thought we were pretty close. I thought you were anti-Heinrich. 12.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
Somewhere along the way, you ended up on Cloud City on a precipice with your hand cut off. And Bulls blogger telling you to join them so you could overthrow Gar Pax. Let's get a little bit into your history as a Bulls fan and how you came to this dark present.
Yeah, well, I feel like when I wrote my most recent season opener that there were a couple comments that, you know, I'm always so negative. Well, really, like you said, it hasn't always been that way. Like during the heyday of the D-Rose, Noah era, I mean, I was all about the Bulls at that point. I really loved the direction of the team. It just felt like a roster that really resonated with the city. So I was all about the Bulls during those years. Obviously, we know how that all played out. It, you know, didn't have the sustainable success we were hoping it did. And I feel like since then, you know, the Rose injury still comes up so often. Whenever you hear the front office or ownership speak, they sort of continue to use it as a crutch, in part because they haven't been able to build a real contender since then. Now they've committed to this full rebuild. So I think it's going to be a really long process for the Bulls and their fans of like getting back into the market of being, you know, one of the better teams in the Eastern Conference. Even just making the playoffs would take massive improvement from this team right now. So it's going to be a long process, I think. My take on the season so far is that it only confirms my suspicion the Bulls are going to be much closer to picking number one overall in the draft than they will making the playoffs. But, you know, that could be a good thing for the long-term chances of the rebuild, too. So in general, you know, I think that as long as Paxton and Foreman are still in place, I'm always going to have some skepticism if they can really pull off this rebuild. But I do like a couple of the pieces, and you know, I'm excited to see how it plays out.
So you do like a couple of pieces. Deep down, I think there's still belief or good within you. Like, I think at some level you got to believe that these guys can do it with their history of relatively good draft picks. Is there any hope there?
Well, yeah, the draft is definitely the most important thing, right? So I like Markkanen, I like Carter. Having your top two building blocks in the front court, I feel like that does limit your flexibility a bit. It's like in this era, you know, maybe Markkanen should be playing a lot of minutes at the five, but we'll see how whoever this Bulls coach is long-term sort of handles that with the Markkanen-Carter pairing. We still haven't seen them on the court together, so that'll be a really fascinating development once Lowry returns from injury. I think LaVine has shown quite a bit too so far. Yes. He's still a flawed player. I do wonder if he you know, ultimately can have a positive contribution to winning. But he's someone who I identified as someone in the draft who I liked really early. I covered the draft for SB Nation every year. In Zach LaVine's year, that was 2014. That was one of the first drafts I did. And LaVine was one of my guys in that draft. I felt like his natural talent was just so obvious. At the time, Steve Alford at UCLA was playing his son ahead of him, Bryce Alford, which was just made me want to blow my mind out. And I think, you know, since LaVine has come into the league, he's continued to do well. A lot of the things that he's done well in college, I'd say he's gotten better at his strengths, but he hasn't really improved his weaknesses. So still only 23 years old. He obviously has a lot of time to grow. His offensive efficiency has just been incredible to start this season so far.
Yeah. He's definitely taken it to the hoop with reckless abandon, which is to me a massive improvement on what we saw last year and, you know, for the vast majority of his short career. So I have hope. I'm still a little down on his defense. I don't see a lot of improvement that some people seem to see, but hopefully that will come along too. I did want to ask you a quick question, just to take a step back. 2011-12, did you believe that team could have won a title?
11-12, so that was the year Rose tore his ACL against the Sixers.
April.
Yeah, I mean maybe. That was a hell of a Miami team, though. That was when Miami finally realized it didn't need to play Joel Anthony at center, and they slid everyone up the position, and Bosh went to center, and LeBron went to the four, and everything changed. So that probably was the best Miami team. So I don't know if the Bulls could have beat them. I mean, we all saw what happened the year before, but the fact of the matter is, like, it was so great just to feel like there was a chance. You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
That team proved us wrong time and time again, I think, like, from when they were formed into, like, you know, starting with D-Rose saying, you know, why can't I be MVP? That team going from an 8 seed to getting the number 1 seed in the conference 2 years in a row. When a team exceeds expectations like that again and again, you start to believe that anything's possible. So I won't sit here and say with a lot of conviction I think that Bulls team would have beaten the Heat, but I think they had a puncher's chance, and I can't wait till the Bulls get back to that point where now it's like, I'm looking at the 2020 and 21 NBA draft to plot out the Bulls' long-term rebuild. It's like, this just sucks compared to where it was before when you could really talk yourself into them having a chance to go to the finals every year in the East.
Yeah, I will say, I mean, when Rose tore his ACL, people, it's easy to forget, but Miami wasn't the Miami Heat that we know today. In their rearview mirror, they had the disaster of losing to a inferior Dirk Nowitzki and his band of cohorts that really wasn't as talented as the Heat, and there were still a lot of doubts about LeBron and a lot of doubts, and I just felt like that team could have done it. Derek tears his ACL, never approaches where he was right before this 5-year contract starts. And the thing that I think gets lost is not only did he never approach what he was, but the other key part of that team was Noah, and he also went from first team All-NBA to a guy who really couldn't even play in the playoffs within a year.
Yeah, Noah's decline was just so swift and so dramatic. It's like just fell off the cliff after a while. And I even remember that playoff series against the Wizards when they lost. That was the year they had DJ Augustine. It's like Noah was throwing up some heinous garbage around the rim that year. Like, he wasn't even coming close on, like, 4-foot shots. He had no athleticism at that point, no explosiveness. And when you think about it, it's like, why was Noah so good in the first place? He's like 6'11", 230, so he was never like – he never had great positional size for a center. His skill level was high in, like, unique ways. Like, he could handle and pass the ball well, but it's never like he could bank on his jump shot being a go-to weapon for him. He was really good because he had incredible focus and great athleticism and lateral quickness. And when that athleticism and explosiveness started to go – Noah just fell off so quickly, which is a shame because at his peak he was such a fun player to root for.
I just can't think of any other team where two core players like that just decline to that level, to go from first team All-NBA to, you know, they're barely at one point. I mean, Rose obviously has shown he has more life, but Noah's not in the NBA. It's insane. Let's move on. Bad news to the present, to the present. Horrible news with Dunn's injury today. And you know, I've maintained over the course of this summer that Dunn has the biggest delta between him and the backup, and this is just a devastating blow. I thought they could have at least treaded water until Lowry came back, but this is not good. And what say you? What's your opinion about the injury to our beloved Dunn?
Yeah, I totally agree with you, and it's a shame because if you followed Chris Dunn's career dating back to, you know, the start of his college career, he just cannot stay durable to save his life. When he entered college at Providence, he was a McDonald's All-American, one of the most hyped recruits in the country. He comes in, has a shoulder injury, season-ending shoulder injury within like the first two games his freshman year, comes back the next year, has another season-ending shoulder injury. So then in his third college year, he finally got on the court, was able to establish himself, ends up staying mostly healthy for that year and what was his fourth year in college when he ultimately became the fifth pick in the draft. But then even we saw last year, he had the injury against the Warriors. He just wasn't able to totally stay on the court, and it's a shame because, as you said, there's a huge drop-off between Dunn and the other point guards on this roster. I really have not seen much from Cam Payne at all. He's going to continue to get an opportunity. Archie Diacono, I feel like, is just a guy. I mean, he can be an okay caretaker, I guess, but he's not really moving the needle.
He's less than a guy. He's terrible. He's less than that. He's terrible. Yeah. I mean, the Bulls Twitter treats him like, you know, like I say, like overbearing parents treat their toddler who does anything halfway well, and they're calling, you know, Grandma, look what Archie did. You know, he just made a basket, and people, you know, they're calling all his relatives to talk about it. It's so ridiculous. The guy is such a limited. On your last podcast though, did you say that Payne is the worst player ever? Is that true?
I said that. Name a worse player than Cameron Payne, and you know what?
Yeah, Archie
Payne stuck it to me in that Pistons game.
He sure did.
he was really good, especially in that third quarter. I think he had four straight buckets. So good for you, Cameron Payne. Shove it in my face. Oh, sorry for cussing.
That's all right.
Because
I'll delete it off.
I'm glad he did that though, because you know he hadn't had many moments since he came to Chicago. So it was nice to see him finally get a little positive momentum.
He shot 38% from three last year. I didn't think he was terrible last year. I thought he was average. Yeah, but agreed though. I think we're both in agreement. These two guys are just so far away. Do you have any hope for the two new guys they brought on board?
I like Ulis. I followed Ulis for a while, but I mean, Ulis, again, he's just limited physically. He's so small. I don't really see him being an impactful defender. Really, for him, it's going to come down to his jump shot. So now, like, the reality of the situation for the Bulls is, like, a lot of these teams nowadays have gone away from, like, a pure point guard, and in its place, it's more of, like, an offensive initiator. Like, Ben Simmons isn't, like an actual point guard in a lot of ways, being 6'10 and 240 pounds, but he's the initiator on that team, meaning he's the guy who is handling the ball in the pick and rolls. He's the guy who's getting the offense going early in the shot clock. James Harden, another example, of course, in Houston. You can find that all over the league, even Giannis. They come in all different sorts of shapes and sizes these days, and LaVine is going to be that guy for the Bulls. So I think the Dunn injury, you know, if you're looking for one silver lining of it, I want to see Zach LaVine kind of expand his arsenal a little bit, and that starts with seeing the floor better and being a better passer, because we know he can really stockpile points in a hurry. His offensive talent is just so obvious if you've seen him at all in the first three games of this season, but to really be someone who influences winning at a greater level, he's going to need to, you know, be a more willing and unselfish passer and have better vision. So there's your silver lining with the Dunn injury. I think LaVine has the ball in his hands a lot more now, and we'll see if he's can show us anything that he hasn't in the past.
What's your opinion on Chandler Hutchinson? I thought he had some nice moments yesterday. I don't understand why he's not playing more, since I have a very low opinion of Justin Holiday. Would you have, number one, preferred just to keep Nico, or would you do you feel like Hutchinson has the ability and the, you know, possibility of being a contributor, high-level player?
To me, the thing is, like, when you made the decision to trade Butler, at that point, you might as well sell off Nico, despite the fact that Nico was really good, just because he didn't really align with the path. I mean, last year they were 3-20 until Nico comes back. Nico starts tearing it up, and then suddenly a team that looked like they were going to have a chance to pick at number one is now at number seven. I mean, I think ideally the best path for the Bulls would have just been keeping a lot of the guys they had on the roster already, with Mirotić, with Butler, leading the team. And then, you know, you look at some of the other guys that had Spencer Dinwiddie in here. He's turned into a really nice player for the Nets. Maybe you use the money you gave to Wade and sign someone like Eric Gordon or another scorer in the backcourt from that free agency class. Even Rondo by himself, that was a decent signing. So Yeah, I think that Mirotić is really, really good. I wouldn't be surprised if he's an all-star this year in the West. That might be, you know, the highest end of his upside. But I have quite a bit of faith in him that he can sustain this, because we've seen it really since he came back from the Bulls last year. He was terrific for the Pelicans down the stretch. I think he's a really effective player. At the same time, it's like once you traded Butler, the Bulls sort of went, you know, all in on this rebuild. And at that point, I think you open up a spot for the player that's eventually Wendell Carter. It was the right move, probably trading him, just because once you traded Butler, it didn't make much sense to keep Mirotić. In terms of Chandler Hutchinson, I do not have a strong opinion on him. I think that, you know, the jury's majorly still out. He definitely passes the eye test in a sense, because he just looks like an NBA player. He's 6'8", lanky wing. He can put the ball on the floor and handle it a little bit. He had a really nice left-handed finish against the Mavericks in what was really like his first real opportunity to play minutes in the Dallas game. So I'm totally going into the Hutchinson thing with an open mind. I think he has a chance to be good, but I don't feel a lot of conviction in it one way or another.
It's interesting what you said about Nico. I mean, I've always felt Nico, that was pure Nico when he comes back to a 3-20 team with no pressure on him and he performs well. That's what Nico does. I mean, when he's with the three alphas and he's the most important guy in the team because he's the one guy that can extend the floor, he goes, shoots 30% for his first 200 three-point attempts, you know. So I was so glad to see him go. I do realize now I'm steering into the abyss of him potentially on the All-Star team, which would be devastating, because then I'd have to deal with our friend from Australia, you know, pretty much daily reminding me that. But it all depends on how good Hutchinson is. And I don't understand, though. I did see you tweet yesterday about – you had a question on the number 24. I mean, on the promise. What was the issue with that? I'm a little confused on that article.
Well, the Bulls are just so compromised with their relationship with Mark Bartlestein. It's like, does Hutchinson get promised if he's not a Bartlestein client? They show such favoritism towards his agency. So it's like – all right, the scenario in which the Hutchinson, or like the promise thing, the only way that looks really good for them
is if he's good.
Is if Hutchinson turns out and kills it, right. So yeah, that's totally possible. That's on the table. But it seems, I would say, very likely that he still would have been on the board regardless when they came, you know, when they made that pick. It just sort of seemed like a lazy and compromised approach to scouting to me, because – he likely would have been available. However, the Bulls can look like geniuses in this scenario and shove Crow in my face and others if Hutchinson is really great. And then it's like, well, he was available because you identified him as a special talent early. You didn't want another team to catch him, you yes. know, to catch wind of him. So you shut down his workouts.
That's exactly
so,
right.
I mean, that's yeah. totally possible.
That's what I mean. It's all that matters. Is he good or not? Yeah. That's all that matters. Right. So I think it's a lot to do about nothing. Was he worth the 24th pick? Well, I mean, we'll find out. You know, 22nd pick, we'll find out.
Yeah.
For or against Coach Fred, I'm just about, you know, he's dead to me right now. I can't take any more. What's your take on
I feel like Fred gets it. I would actually love to talk ball with Fred, like, on a personal level, not on, like, the media level, just because I feel like he grasps the game in ways that his bosses don't. For instance, it took a lot of guts to bench Jabari Parker in the fourth preseason game. I mean, remember, his bosses signed Jabari Parker to be the three. That was the plan coming into this year, and they gave him $20 million to do it. Hoiberg must have looked at that and been like, these guys are idiots. Like, there's no way this guy can be a successful small forward. He probably can't even be a successful power forward. So he had a couple different decisions to make when Markkanen got hurt. Hoiberg could have, you know, kept Jabari at the three and slid Portis to the four, or he could have slid Parker to the four and then, you know, put Justin Holiday or another wing in the lineup. So I thought that that was the first good decision he made, recognizing that Parker was not going to have any success at the three. He had to play the four. So I liked him there. And then pulling the plug on him early, I thought was really a brilliant move for a couple of reasons. First of all, Portis was clearly a better player.
Well, hold on a second. After three games? Let's stop right there. How can
Parker
you say that?
Parker has so many holes in his game. I want to root for Parker, but
yeah.
I just don't think he plays. He doesn't grasp the modern game to me.
Do you think Do you think Parker's a better 3-point shooter than Portis?
Yes. I would say Parker's a better 3-point shooter than Portis.
Is he a better
sure.
passer?
In transition, but they are kind of similar players in the sense that they're both kind of offense-first guys who don't really pass.
I would concur on that, but he's clearly the better passer and better three-point shooter, which is why he should be starting. It's like, it's insanity. We're talking about three preseason games. And you have a role that Portis already embraced. Why is this a good decision?
So that's a good point that Portis embraced it. To me, though, it would have been like, if they would have benched Jabari in the middle of the year, and like Hoiberg's coaching for his job this year, right? Like, Hoiberg thinks that Portis gives him the best chance to win. I feel like there's a good chance Hoiberg loses his job in the middle of the season if the Bulls just continue to stockpile losses this year. Hoiberg is coaching for his job this year. He thinks Portis gives him a better chance to win, and he also realizes the bench needs some kind of scoring punch. He saw him deputize Jabari as a point forward on the second unit because I think Hoiberg realizes how big the drop-off is between Dunn and the other point guards on the roster. And, you know, just in a scenario where, like, they let this thing linger and the Bulls are losing a ton and Hoiberg feels pressure to coach for his job and Jabari's playing no defense and they don't have any scoring on the second unit and then you bench Jabari in the middle of the season, I feel like that would have been a disaster. Like, that probably would have caught everyone way off guard and been, like, a huge talking point in the season that the Bulls, you know, benched him at that point. But doing it so early in the season, I think – was impressive for Hoiberg because he stood up for himself against the front office. He just sort of solved the problem before it became one, in a sense, to me. So, you know, Parker's still going to get an opportunity to play a ton of minutes on this team. He can still get that starting job back if he plays well enough, I think. But early in the season, he just wasn't in good enough shape. And, you know, he didn't prove that he deserved it over Portis.
Yeah, definitely. I agree that over the first three preseason games, I thought Parker was much better yesterday in – you know, long term, I think is better with. I think everything you said there, you could say about Portis. Portis is to me a better answer on the as a sixth man. He's you know the go to guy in that second team. But I know I'm on an island on this one. It seems like that your take is definitely the more popular one. And I did you know I did talk to Pax? That was the first question I asked him about. Was it your decision to send Parker to the bench? And he said it was Fred's, and he backed it up. Were you aware of that?
No.
I ran into him at the Bulls game when I went there against Denver in the last preseason game.
Interesting.
That's the first question I asked him. I go, was that your decision? Yeah, and Pax is a great guy, regardless of what you think of him.
Yeah.
And I suspected it was his decision because, you know, there's no commitment to Parker. He'll be gone after this year. It's clear this isn't going to work out. So,
yeah.
But that's what he said. It was Fred's decision, and he backed it. So, for what it's worth.
Interesting.
Top three Garpax moves in your bottom three Garpax moves.
Top three Garpax moves. Drafting Rose, drafting Noah, and hiring Tibbs.
Oh, God. Come on. How about Jimmy Butler at 30? That's got to be
Jimmy Butler at 30 is a hell of a move, too.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Tibbs, I know. So you're a Tibbs guy. I think Tibbs had a lot to do with the early breakdown of some of our key players.
But. Yeah, I think so, too. But, like, Tibbs is, like, family at this point. Like, now that I'm more removed from it, I kind of view that era of Bulls basketball just, like, so fondly, even though, you know, they never totally broke through. It's like, I mean, it doesn't need to – that whole situation doesn't need to be rehashed. But
you recall that exactly, Rose being not the slam dunk that it was. I mean, I remember getting into tons of arguments with Bulls fans.
Totally.
About Beasley, and not only that, a lot of Heinrich drones. We already got a point guard. You remember that? You do remember that. What would you estimate out of the Bulls fan base was for Beasley?
At the time, like when they immediately won the lottery, I felt like it was more pro Beasley. Like the day they won the lottery, and then it sort of switched over to everyone realizing it was going to be Rose, and that everyone was kind of excited it was going to be Rose. But I mean, that was very much a toss up, like league wide at the time. If Rose was born not in Chicago, who knows if they take him over Beasley in that situation? You know what I mean? Like, that's how close it was at the time, and they obviously made the right call on that.
No doubt. And then they got Noah after a 49 win season. And that was
drafted him over Spencer Hawes.
Yes. And you remember how they got that, though, after winning 49 games, why they were in position to get Noah?
Was that the Eddie Curry trade?
That's right. I can't trick you, man. You're definitely on top of this stuff. If that was Mark, you had no idea. So I win the lottery and name you VP of operations. Who is our coach and who is our GM? Assuming you're going to fire Garpax, which I think is pretty...
Yeah, they're out. You know, I just feel like they need more of an analytics guy. They need sort of a new school numbers guy. To me, it's like the Parker mistake is the same thing as the Wade mistake, which was horrible. I feel like the Wade signing is more disastrous for this franchise than people even realize, because it led to them being put in a position where they almost had to trade Jimmy Butler. They were just going to run it back with Wade in the second year of that contract when he wasn't worth it. So we're firing Garpax. I don't know. I want an analytically inclined guy. Mike Zarin is the Celtics' number two. I think that he could be pretty good if they want to go with him. He's sort of like one of the younger rising GM candidates. So, you know, you just want someone in that mold. The Bulls need their Theo, right? Someone who understands the modern game and can sort of make sound decisions for that. Unlike Paxton, who just seems to have a lifetime contract, and the only way he's going to lose his job is if he tries to quit. And the last time he tried to quit, they gave him a promotion. So I just want someone with more distance, I think, from ownership, and someone who's a little more analytically inclined. So we'll go Mike Zarin, Celtics number two right now.
How about coach?
Coach, I don't really know. I don't have a coach off the top of my head. I know you asked me this earlier, so I should be prepared with an answer, and I'm not. Do you have someone in mind that you would like?
No, I mean, Budenholzer would have been my favorite choice.
He's obviously tremendous.
You know, just some offensive-minded coach who's got – the problem with Fred, and I kind of agree with you, Fred's not a dummy. He's not an idiot. He's a very smart guy when it comes to basketball, but he doesn't have that leadership quality, I think, that, you know, engenders men to say, I want to follow that guy. He's just so too weak. He doesn't have that dominant personality I think you do need to have. And some people will say, well, you know, Celtics don't really have that with Brad. He's kind of in that mold, isn't he? I think Stevens is just so smart that people just naturally respect him.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you there. I mean, it's tough to defend Fred when you realize that he got the job without a real coach search. It's like, you know, he came into this self-appointed, in a sense, by the front office, that they knew they were going to give him a chance. I don't think the front office has given him a great chance to, you know, run a system. I would have loved to see what a Fred Hoiberg team would have looked like with Mirotić being more empowered as a ball handler next to Butler as the co-star. I feel like that team could have been really interesting. Throw Etuan Moore on there if you want to keep him. You get Dinwiddie. Maybe you keep Rondo. Sign a free agent instead of Wade. I feel like that could have been a really interesting Fred Hoiberg team. Unfortunately, that team never materialized. They went with the rebuild. And I do think that Hoiberg is on majorly thin ice this season. I would actually be surprised if he finishes the season as the Bulls coach. But, you know, it's not just on him. It's like he's sort of in a no-win situation at this point. And really, the ultimate judgment of Fred Hoiberg will come if he gets another job and how well he does there. Because his Bulls tenure obviously has been, I mean, a bummer or maybe even a disaster. But I still don't think, you know, you can call him the worst coach in the NBA, or like you said, he's not a dummy. So
he's supposed to be, though, an offensive guru, and we still haven't been in the top half yet. So yeah. At some point, you got enough talent. You've had Jimmy Butler. I think this team is loaded with offensive talent. Let's at least see us get in the top 15. If you can't do it, then pound sand. I mean, my God.
Sure.
One more question I had for you before we part ways, my man, is talk a little bit about the Butler trade. You're, I think, one of the few people left that I respect and I find intelligent who doesn't believe the Bulls won the Butler trade. Make the case why.
Yeah, well, I've said it a few times on here already, but it's like what really screwed the Bulls was signing Wade. I mean, giving him a player option on the back end of that deal. Like, the Bulls gave Wade a golden parachute contract that, like, the Lakers give to Kobe Bryant because he's accomplished so much for the franchise. Dwayne Wade didn't do anything for the Bulls. Miami wouldn't give him that same golden parachute contract. But the Bulls swoop in, and to me, that signing just, like, spelled doom for the rest of the Jimmy Butler era. Like, that should have been the offseason when you built the team around Jimmy, found players who accentuated his strengths. You know, you take Mirotić, who looked terrible during that three alphas year. Well, Mirotić, the majority of the time, was made to be a spot-up shooter with Wade and Rondo and Butler jab-stepping for 20 seconds on the shot clock. Mirotić, you know, be put in a tough position. He never really got to show his ball handling and creation abilities that he did last year. He was playing in a more wide-open system. So that's what I go back to. It's like the rebuild is fine, but, like, look at the Magic's rebuild without Dwight Howard. They still haven't made the playoffs. They still haven't come close to making the playoffs. It's tough to trade a superstar and to totally pull it off. Now, the Bulls did get some good pieces back, I think.
No doubt.
LaVine looks solid. I really like Markkanen quite a bit. Dunn, I mean, who knows? Is Chris Dunn the Bulls' point guard of the future? I think that heading into his last year of the contract, he still has a lot to prove. You know, Levine, while talented, obviously a flawed player. I think even, you know, his biggest supporters would accept that at this point. He still needs to improve on some obvious deficiencies in his game. So to me, it's like the rebuild is just going to be a really long process. Like, we could still be in this rebuild mode 2-3 years from now. Now, you know, the one thing that could change that is some great drafting. Markkanen, I think, was better as a rookie than most people anticipated him to be. If he continues to progress in this year, proves that him and Levine can play off each other a little bit, I think that would be a terrific foundation for the rest of the team. I'm also really high on Carter. I think they need someone who's a plus two-way player for one, another high IQ guy who can pass the ball alongside Levine and Markkanen. So the rebuild's got some nice pieces, but, I mean, man, they theoretically could have had a team that, you know, who knows, could have contended in the Eastern Conference if they kept Butler. Now that LeBron's out of the conference, especially if you go Butler, Mirotic, you know, Dinwiddie or Rondo, maybe sign an Eric Gordon or another guard to that spot where you signed Wade, keep Etuan. I think that could have been a really interesting team. And, you know, at that point, like, see, the thing is that everyone always says that, like, that team would have been capped because Jimmy Butler is maybe the 12th best player in the NBA instead of, like, the 3rd best player in the NBA.
Correct.
But when you're in that position, like, just accepting that is such a loser's attitude. And that's what disappoints me about Paxson, because he, like, beats his chest and tries to be such a tough guy, competitive mindset. But really, he gave up when he had Jimmy Butler on a team-friendly deal because he couldn't build a good team around him through no one's fault but his own. It's like, that was the coward's move, trading Butler, just being like, yeah, we have this great two-way superstar who's homegrown and who, you know, worked his ass off to be put in this position, but we're too dumb to build around him, so we're just going to trade him.
I got it. Let me be the Pax advocate for a second here. What makes you think that Nico Mirotic would have done well with Jimmy Butler? There's nothing in his history to show that. Heck, Towns can't even play well with Jimmy Butler, and he's a far more talented player than Nico Mirotic.
I do think that Butler's game and Mirotic's game complements each other well. I mean, Butler's all about these headstrong drives to the basket, and Mirotic is able to space it out a bit. He can also handle the ball, which is what I think was what really unlocked him as being a good player at the end of his Bulls tenure and in his Pelicans tenure, is that he's able to, like, you know, run some pick and rolls and do some creation stuff. I think him and Butler could have played off each other well in that regard, too. When the Bulls wanted another, you know, playmaker next to Jimmy Butler, they got Dwayne Wade, who didn't complement him well at all. So I understand what you're saying, that we never saw Mirotic prove that he could blend in, or we've never seen anyone prove they could blend in, I guess, with Butler and his style of play and just his style of leadership as well. But I do think the on-court fit between them should have been mutually beneficial, at least on paper.
Yeah, I mean, it was over for me when Jimmy came back 2-0, and game three he put up one of the worst performances I've ever seen from a Chicago Bull in a game that you just had to win after Rondo was hurt. And, you know, we're not going to win anything with that. You just can't. He's a very good player. He's definitely, I put him in 12 to 17, but if he's going to be your taking up 130 of your cap, it's going to be really difficult to win with that, especially when you just kind of said, though, that Nico, how did they use him with Nico and Wade? It wouldn't be any different than how they used him with Butler and Wade. If you take Wade off the team, it's still the same Nico. I'm a little confused as how you think he would have been used differently.
Well, I think that, like, if you would have empowered him as the second sort of star on the team, like, this is Butler's co-star, I think his role would have been much different. I mean, when he was in the 3 Alphas era, it wasn't called the 4 Alphas era. Like, Mirotic was very much pushed to the side. This was about Wade and Butler versus the world. And the world was led by Rajon Rondo. It was a really messed up scenario, and no one was happy about it. So the Bulls, you know, they didn't want to run that back for a second year. But I do think that, you know, Mirotic's skill set should have fit well with Butler's.
Agreed. But they continually tried to empower Nico. You remember, they benched Noah. They benched Fred. That was his first act. Let's bench Noah and start Nico. And what did Nico do? He kept falling on his face.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, the thing is that Mirotic and Butler are both two of those players who can never seem to get out of their own way, like, for better or for worse. It's like, if they could have done that, you would have think their skill sets would have meshed together well, but, you know, it's a game full of personalities and egos, and some stuff like that really influences how things play out.
To wrap this up, let's give a little bit of background about you. You're kind of a mystery figure here. in that, you know, I do feel like I come from a side of Chicago where I hear a lot of the mouth breather platitudes. You know, defense wins championships, fire guard packs, hire Tibbs, Jabari doesn't care, Heinrich is great, all these moronic bumper sticker mantras. And you're the only one who I really respect who repeats those, and I kind of, you know, understand that you're going to have a background for it. So why don't we get a little bit about you in your history so people understand the mystery behind Ricky O'Donnell.
Yeah, I've lived in the city, or, you know, in the area my whole life. I grew up in Orland Park, went to college in the city of Columbia, and have been lucky enough to write about basketball for my full-time job since I graduated. So, you know, I got into this because I grew up during the Jordan years in Chicago. I don't really remember the first three championships. I'm 31, so I was a little young for the first three titles, but I remember the last three well, and, you know, that's what really got me into loving basketball. I mean, at the same time, the Bears had the worst quarterbacks of all time, one after another, and
no doubt, so true. You're from Orland Park.
Yeah.
What high school did you go to, Andrew?
Providence Catholic.
Get out! I went to St. Lawrence, Oak Lawn.
Cool.
I knew. I sensed some at one point a kindred spirit in you, and then you've gone down the dark side to the Bulls blogger side, and I don't know what to say. Hopefully, I can bring you back. Maybe
hey,
if I sacrifice
hope
myself.
Pull this off, man. We're both rooting for him to pull it off.
Obi-Wan style. Yeah, agreed. I think it still can happen. That's interesting. So, and then let's share with everyone where everybody can find you now.
Yeah, you can find my work at SBNation.com. I mostly cover college basketball and sort of the pipeline to the NBA. I do a lot of draft coverage, a lot of college hoops coverage, some high school recruiting stuff as well. So I kind of follow the path on the elite kids from you know, high school through the NBA draft. So you can find all that work at SBNation.com, on the college page and the NBA page. And then when I write about the Bulls, it's usually at bloggable.com, which is the Bulls site of SB Nation.
And then one more with the podcast.
And we got a podcast. Jason Pat and I just started it this year. We're two episodes in. We're going to record the third episode tonight. It's called Cash Considerations, because Jason and I just could not help ourselves from taking another pot shot at the Bulls. So I'm sure they love us for that. And people were texting me when we came out with the podcast that I guess you're not going to get invited to Gar Forman's holiday party this year. Well, I wasn't going to get invited anyway. So,
did the three best college players that you've seen, or high school players that you think the Bulls will be able to hopefully draft now that Dunn is out?
Yeah, I'm really familiar with this next class because I watched them at the AAU level and at the USA basketball level over the last year. So I think, you know, there's four names that you want to keep an eye on that would all be really great fits for the Bulls. Three of them are at Duke. That's Zion Williamson, RJ Barrett, and Cam Reddish. Zion's the most unique player of the bunch. He's not a shooter, but he's much more than a dunker. I think, you know, most people who are listening to this probably have some idea, some familiarity with Zion Williamson. 6'6", 285 pounds, would be, you know, the second heaviest player in the NBA today at only 6'6". Explosive athlete, great rebounder, and, you know, intimidating shot blocker. But he's more than just a dunker, too, because I think he can handle the ball, and he has a high feel for the game. And he's just someone who, like, makes plays on both ends.
Mm-hmm.
I really like him quite a bit. There's also Cam Reddish. He reminds me a bit of Tracy McGrady in that he's so naturally talented that people sort of question his intensity and, like, his will to win and these, like, empty platitudes. But if you look at him, I mean, the kid is just so talented. 6'8" or 6'9" ball handler who can stroke threes off the dribble or on the catch. He's going to be at Duke this year as well. And the consensus number one guy is RJ Barrett, who's just been a monster in terms of productivity at every level. So watch some Duke games this year if the Bulls are really falling flat. And then Nazir Little is the other guy. He's going to be a freshman at North Carolina this year. Sort of in the Jaylen Brown mold, a really strong, hard-charging wing. It'll be interesting to see where his jump shot's at this year, but, you know, he sort of projects as the type of two-way wing the Bulls could really use. So the short end of it is that the Bulls would greatly benefit from a top four pick this year to get one of those four guys, because that kind of player that all those guys represents, that's exactly what this Bulls rebuild is missing at this point.
You could drop all four of those in at the three?
Williamson's more of a four, but he's been handling the ball a lot for Duke at this point. So, I mean, we'll see. It's still too early to say, but I think that they would all, you know, greatly benefit just the overall talent level of the roster.
Great. Ricky, thank you so much for your time, brother. It was great having you on the Bullseye, and I will continue to follow you and enjoy your work. And maybe one day we can hold hands again.
Thanks, Brad.
Take it easy, bro. Bye-bye.